So here I am in Chicago looking out at a clean sheet of ice where Blackhawks and Bruins will be skating before you know it.
It's very exciting.
2 days from now. And I understand, Mr. Merrick, that you, although I am completely alone right now, I don't even see Patrick Sharp moisturizing in the corner anywhere. I am completely alone. You, sir, have guests.
I have an entourage. I have a camp. I have a crew. I have a posse. As I look out here, you're in Chicago. I'm in Toronto at the Sportsnet 590 studio overlooking a lovely high-rise overlooking... what street is that? Is that Huntley Street? Is that Huntley Street, Josh?
Yeah, Huntley or Isabella or
Huntley
something.
Huntley Street, yeah. Or maybe, is it Isabella? I don't know. That's Huntley Street.
Toronto.
Joined by two stars of the interwebs that you know and love on this podcast. One, Ellen Etchingham from the Backhand Shelf blog, and... Attention, Mr. Campbell, if you're paying attention, if you're listening to the program right now. Tyler Dello, MC79Hockey.com, joining us here live in the studio, Greg Wyshynski. So it's roundtable time here on the podcast.
If I may begin with a question for Tyler Dello, because Constable Dello, I know he has a familiarity with this family. What do you think about the deifying of Gregory Campbell as a playoff icon by the Boston Bruins and their media?
I'm not really big on it. Like, I'm impressed that he blocked the shot and he does all the things that we like our hockey players to do. But at the same time, like, the shot hit him in the leg. He didn't know his leg was broken, so he stood up for a minute.
But hang on a second. But he knows that it doesn't tickle. Like, he stands up and tries to put pressure on it and probably says to himself, hang on a second. This ain't groovy movie.
Okay. No, fair enough. Alishamsky got hit with a puck this year, broke his foot, stayed out for the rest of his shift, went off the ice. Nobody's talking about how tough Alishamsky is.
Did he know that did he feel that he had broken it? Because you can break your foot and not know it.
Well, he must have, because he could hardly move around the ice. Like, he was like sort of just skating in little circles, much like what Campbell was doing.
Campbell said that it felt different. Like, he didn't know it was broken. He actually said in his press conference the other day he doesn't have X-ray vision, so he couldn't tell for sure whether or not it was broken. But he said something felt different is what he said.
Yeah, I believe that. I broke my collarbone once hitting a guy, and then I went back to the bench, and I spent 15 minutes trying to pop my shoulder back in. And then I realized that, you know, the shoulder seemed to be in a socket, but the bone didn't seem to be connected. So, you know, in my experience, sometimes you break stuff and you don't realize it's broken. So,
you know, This is an interesting sort of jump-off point for, Ellen, your latest blog, talking about the nature, let me get this right, you know, the nature of injuries and how some are vilified and others are sort of demonized. And you couch it under the umbrella of player safety with the difference between beating out an icing, if your name is Pat Peake, it costs you your career, and blocking a shot, it costs you the Stanley Cup playoffs if you're Gregory Campbell.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question about
it? No. I was just hoping you could sort of riff on that. But if you want a direct question is, do you see a difference between the two? Like, why is one more of a noble act than the other? Why is beating out icing looked at as, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, whereas blocking a shot, it's, you know, you become part of hockey lore. Gregory Campbell's now become in the Bobby Bond style of, oh, look at the ultimate sacrifice he made for his team.
I think it has to do with the intensity of the moment. Usually when you race back for an icing call, most of the time you get the whistle, it's an icing, you go to the face off the other end. It's a fundamentally boring play. And even when the player actually touches it up and beats the icing, it still often doesn't really directly lead to anything dramatic. When you're blocking a shot, you're really like in the direct role of protecting your team from... And especially on penalty kill, like Campbell was. Like, even if it's maybe not a shot that would have gone in, you're, like, putting your body in between the opposition and your net.
Right.
So...
But isn't beating out an icing essentially the same thing? You're trying to keep the play alive to create advantage for your team. Like, I know what you mean. Just one looks more dramatically different, and we feel differently about it. But should we?
I think that's one of the, you can't tell people how to feel about moments, though. And I think that the fact that icings are so routinely boring means that people will judge the entire gesture of racing for an icing on all of the ones they've seen, which most of are not interesting plays. Whereas, you know, somebody getting a shot or a scoring chance and that being blocked is always dramatic.
Well,
did we just lose Wish? Oh, well. That's enough of him. Finally, we can actually have a real conversation without the American getting in the way. Oh, wait a minute. We do have an American room in Ellen Etchingham.
She's sort of a quasi-Canadian, though.
Yeah.
She's got 10 months here. We're a melting pot.
I lived here for 3 years.
3 years here. All right. She's got the time in Montreal, too. We credit her with that.
So and you're from Chicago, too, which should be, you know, which right now is
the other thing, too.
And everyone piled. Oh, you're back, Wish. Where'd you go?
Yeah, I dropped off. I was going to say that I'm having some internet issues. It sounds fine, but it keeps on dropping off. But it is what it is. I was going to say that I tell people what to do all the time when it comes to how they should feel about a certain play or a certain thing. But more so than that, so when we're talking about an injury on an icing, we're talking about a play in which maybe there's some contact, there's a collision, some guy goes flying into the boards and shatters his leg, yeah? I mean, it's that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the contrast I would draw is between the Nathan Horton injury during the Bruins Cup run and this Gregory Campbell thing. And in both cases, they're using it as a source of inspiration. But there's no question the Horton thing, maybe it's because of the stretcher, maybe whatever. The Horton thing was more like, we've got to get those bastards for what they did. And maybe it's because it happened in the same series as the Stanley Cup final. But I always feel like that injuries that occur when there's blame to be placed on an opponent are going to be the ones that cause you to rally the hardest. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, but at the same time, too, it's weird because that Nathan Horton injury, I would actually pin some of the blame on Nathan Horton himself.
How dare you, sir?
Admiring his pass over the blue line. I'm sorry.
Sir, that man is a national treasure. He had a debilitating concussion that forced him to stay away from the arena for weeks. Oh, wait, no, he came back the next day and the lights were bright. No, listen. I think in some cases, head down, putting yourself in harm's way, that's correct.
Over the
but,
blue line.
But in Horton's case, they were never going to see it that way. They treated it like he was assaulted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just on the shot blocking thing, I think Ellen's got an interesting point about how it gets treated. Like, people still treat shot blocking like it's 1970 and nobody blocks shots.
Everybody
so when does. A guy blocks, exactly, everybody does it now. Like, if you read Ken Dryden's book, he talked about some defenseman who came up. And he was at first he blocked shots, but then he was just like all the others.
And Flamingo.
Absolutely. You don't even hear Flamingo on TV anymore. And yet, when I was a kid, in 1990, I still remember Cherry talking about Gretzky on some goal in a Kings Oilers series. And he's like, Gretzky's out there. You Flamingos, you kids out there. You know,
never
you,
Flamingo.
Exactly. And so, but we still sort of treat shot blocking like it's this epic thing when now, you know, it's something everybody does. So it's. To me, he blocked a shot and caught in the wrong spot.
I would also say I think part of what makes the Gregory Campbell thing special is that he's out playing for a long time while visibly incapacitated.
Right.
And hockey loves that. Like, I think more than anything else about violence in hockey.
Tennis loves that. Football loves that. I think every sport loves
that. But, I mean, in hockey, it's very deep, and it goes into a lot of the imagery we love. Like, you look at the montages before games, and they love, the guys with blood on their faces and, visible stitches. And the more you can see a person playing through having been seriously hurt, the more people respond to it emotionally, I think.
I think we also like it when it's real, because we've been so conditioned to see guys embellish and stay down longer than they should, that when we see an actual injury involving an actual player playing through actual pain, it's kind of refreshing, isn't it?
It is, but I do wonder on that play, too, what if Boston doesn't defend successfully? What if Boston gets scored on that PK? And essentially, because, you know, Gregory Campbell essentially took himself out of the play. I mean, he did hold his position, and good for him for doing that. But he's turned a 5-on-4 into a 5-on-3, essentially, in that position. If Boston gets scored on that power play, are we still saying the exact same thing about Gregory Campbell or not? Or are we saying things like, why didn't he just stay down and try to get a whistle? He's being tough, but is he being smart?
People in Boston would be saying the exact same things about him. I don't think it matters. They just want to, you know.
They want a hero?
Yeah, exactly. Gregory Campbell's a big guy. Yeah, I don't know. If the Pens had just sort of realized, maybe picked up a little more that he couldn't move and focused on creating a shot from that spot on the ice because he couldn't, you know, get there and scored, it's a completely different thing. I don't really get the whole deification part of it anyway, but surely a goal against may have, you know, given to people like me who are like, eh, so what? A little bit more meat when it comes to arguing against it.
I think he's a hero, and I think he embodies the blue-collar aesthetic of the Boston Bruins, don't you?
Who is the ultimate Boston Bruin right now? We have spent so much time talking about the Boston Bruins. We'll get to Chicago in a second because that was an interesting win. One with squandered leads and a goaltender that couldn't catch a cantaloupe, but somehow at the end they come out with a 6-5 victory like it's 1982 again. Which, who do you think the ultimate Boston Bruin is on that team? When you think Boston Bruins, who comes to your mind?
On this team?
Yeah.
Let's see here. I would have to say Johnny Boychuk.
Why Johnny Boychuk?
Johnny Boychuk, because he's a lunch pail player. He has a baby face. And he does things sometimes that go beyond your expectations for his talent level. Like that shot last night that probably would have taken down a building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when he dropped his shoulder, it was over. You guys have like an ultimate Bruin. When you think of the Boston Bruins, can you pick like one player you think? For me, honestly, I think it's Nathan Horton. But can you think of like one guy that you say to yourself, okay, that guy is a Boston Bruin?
Well, you know, actually, Merrick, if I may, your Nathan Horton pick, I think, is very accurate because if there's anything we know about Bruins lore, it's that if you go from one team to another, you'll ultimately find success. I think that's important in the history of the Bruins to know that if you leave one franchise where you couldn't win and go to another franchise, eventually you will win.
Are you going to do your Phil Esposito impression now? Is that what you're getting
no,
at here?
I'm not going to know. Okay. I was going for more of a number 77 reference.
You're going for another cheap shot at Ray Bourque. Well, a lot of people that played with him on those Boston Bruins teams and had their salaries suppressed because he became the ceiling for their salary cap structure would applaud you for that, Greg Wyshynski. Do you guys have an ultimate Bruin?
For me, it's Chara, and I think, you know, right now it's Chara. He sort of fits with the Bruins' tradition of dominant defensemen, you know, with Bourque and Orr. He's toughest guy in the league, probably, in that he can sort of rip guys apart if he feels like it. And they just sort of ignore the fact that he's European and likes to ride a bike. And, you know, he's the prototypical Boston guy. You just don't talk about the parts that aren't.
What do you think, Alan?
I think my instinct is to say Milan Lucic, mm-hmm. like for this Bruins team, just because I think that he kind of embodies all of like the kind of mythology that they've had over the past few years, like everything that's built up around them. It's like that idea that they're good, but they're also scary, and they're sort of scarier than they should be. Like they're scarier than there's any good reason to believe, but this sort of image and this sort of swagger that I think he's put forth that I think then sort of extend people read onto the rest of the team.
Yeah, but do you think anybody's actually scared of the Bruins? Like other teams are like, oh God, we got to play Boston. Like,
yes,
I think in a 7-game series there are.
Really?
I don't think as a one-off they are, but I think when you play like, okay, think about this, Tyler, because you play hockey. Puck goes down into a defenseman's end, right? Goes into his corner. You're Seabrook, you're Oduya, you're Chalmerson. Milan Lucic comes in, slams your face up against the glass. That sucks. Okay, next period, here comes the puck, and here comes that guy again. And last time the situation happened, it didn't tickle.
And yeah, but do really, the Bruins do it so much more than other teams that you're like, oh, God, this is going to be so much different than playing the Rangers? Like, that to me, you know, I have a hard time believing that you know, that sort of element of toughness or willingness to smoke defensemen or Ryan Miller's makes the Bruins that much different from other teams. Like,
you know, what's interesting, sorry, finish it up.
Okay, so say you play the Leafs in a 7-game series. How many times are you as a defenseman going to get pasted in the corner going back for a puck versus, you know, the Bruins? And I guess I wonder how, you know, if the difference is that big or that significant. Like, that's hockey. You're going to get smoked. And if you're a defenseman, you're going to get smoked going back for pucks. And, you know, there's maybe some teams like Chicago who carries the puck more. You're going to get hit a little less. But, it's a part of the game. You may not like it. But the differences from one team to the next aren't so big that you're like, oh, my God, we've got to play the Boston Bruins. Now, I've never played. Maybe players will tell you it's different. But I'd be really interested to hear, actually, players talk about this, you know, the differences of one team to the next.
I think we're also asking the question of how much players themselves on opposing teams are influenced by the narratives about their opponents. I think it's, you can easily say that everybody who doesn't play believes that playing the Bruins is tougher than playing a lot of teams. Whether it's possible that NHL players on other teams have the psychological discipline to sort of recognize what you're saying and be like, well, I'm going to get hit no matter who I play. It's mostly smoke and mirrors. But it could also be that the fact that you're playing a team that has this story associated with it makes you think more about those elements of the game.
Like the Philadelphia thing back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Which still kind of exists to this day, too.
Yeah.
No matter how tough or not tough the Flyers team is, you still assume, the Broad Street Bullies.
I'll say this. I mean, in talking to teams that play the Bruins in playoff series and having done, like, preview pieces when the Capitals play them before this series with Chicago, you do hear players talk more about, in very sort of stark detail, we know we're going to get hit more than you do in other series. Like, I think there is an expectation that there is going to be a certain physicality against the Bruins that you don't normally see. But what Ellen said, I think, is interesting, because when you play Boston, it's not only the mental fortitude to absorb physical pain and physical anguish when you're getting hit by guys like Chara and Lucic, but it's also kind of the mental toughness that comes along with playing a defensive team like this. And there are teams that I think would flat out quit if all of a sudden all of the things that you do really, really well have been taken away from you, and every time you see Chara on the ice, there's no room for you to skate, and then that's what happens, and you end up getting swept in the Eastern Conference Final.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Greg. And it's funny watching Boston. Like, what struck me is just how patient you have to be as a team, particularly if you're an offensive team playing them, like, to sort of change your mindset from, we're just going to have to keep doing things, and it's not going to work as much as we're used to. And we're not going to generate the shots on goal that we're maybe used to. You probably do have to kind of fight yourself a little bit. And this is narrative, and my narrative's no better than anybody else's. But, you know, like, watching them, it just sort of feels like teams, throw themselves at them. And the Bruins just sort of, take away what teams do best. And then finally they sort of strike and stick the goal in. And then all of a sudden you're trying to, do the same thing against them, but you're a goal behind.
Hey, Wish, really quickly before we continue this conversation, breaking news, the Dallas Stars have hired a coach.
Who's that?
Sorry, Buffalo. Lindy Ruff.
Hey!
Now, the head coach of the Dallas Stars. Can't wait to hear him weigh in on the 99 goal.
Well, I'm pretty excited. Maybe a year from now, Lindy Ruff will know who Taylor Hall is and that you don't sit him on the bench.
Oh, a little sensitive about something, perhaps?
Well, I'm just saying, Lindy Ruff took Taylor Hall to the World Championships, and Canada lost.
He's a young man. He just needed some experience. He just had to be along for the ride. There are some veteran players that should have shepherded that team along, and you very well know it's how it is. You want a quick thought on Lindy Ruff here, Wish, new head coach of the Dallas Stars?
I think it's an interesting move, only because I'm trying to figure out what they want to be. You know, they seem like they're in that transitionary phase. Is Lindy Ruff the right guy for a transition phase, or is he a better guy with a veteran team? As we talked about on the show.
Anyway, as Greg Wyshynski was saying before he dropped out there, yeah, Lindy Ruff, the new head coach. It is curious to see what the Dallas Stars sort of become now that they are transitioning away from that older squad and rebuilding themselves. I would submit that Lindy Ruff is a head coach for young hockey players. I mean, that's all he's really had in Buffalo. That's all that Lindy Ruff has had to deal with. He's had young guys that when it's time to get paid, go elsewhere. See Drury, see Briere, see Campbell, all the way down the line. I'm kind of surprised, though, that and maybe he did end up talking to him, but that Jeff Blashill, who the head coach of the Grand Rapids Griffins, who just won the Calder Cup, didn't really get an audience with Jim Nill, considering the between the two. He dropped out again.
But that's where I was going with is, do Blashill? You go with him versus someone? Yeah, do you go with him instead of Grandpa is the question.
Instead of Grandpa?
Well, honestly, right?
I don't know that he's Grandpa.
Who, Ruff? He's like 55. I think that's an excellent point. Like, your point about bringing young players along, that was always kind of a knock on McTavish in Edmonton, was that he didn't bring young players along. But to me, Lindy Ruff hasn't had a lot of superstar-type young talents. But what he's had are guys who are, solid first-liners, really good second-liners. And he has made them into NHL players. And, I think you have to give him a lot of credit for that. And, I think sometimes guys get tagged a bit unfairly with being veteran coaches or coaches who, prefer veterans. And I think your point's a pretty good one, Jeff, about what he's done, even though he screwed it up with Taylor Hall.
It does. That's a bitter spot. It does sort of fly in the face of where the league is moving right now, where your general managers are the guys in the 50s and your coaches are the guys in their 40s. Like, that's the way it's trending now. Like, the league has become young on the ice. Your main players are all in their 20s and affordable. And your GMs are in their 50s and the coaches are in their 40s. So maybe there is some audience for that wish. What do you think, Ellen?
I don't have a lot of opinions. This is where I have to admit that I think everybody has, with 30 teams in the NHL, there's always a couple that you really don't know a lot about or mm-hmm. don't follow closely. And for me, the Stars are that team.
Dallas, yeah.
Yeah. I just don't think about them.
You're never going to make it in hockey media if you say, I don't know.
But you know, it's the most refreshing thing you can say.
But Ellen, that actually makes you an honorary citizen of Dallas to know nothing about the Stars. So, I mean, is that too? Sorry, that's a cheap shot. There's a lot of good fans in Dallas. I'm just kidding.
Hey, man, Twitter's interesting today. We got the Daniel Briere. We want to touch on the Daniel Briere buyout as well, and the non-buyout of Ilya Bryzgalov. Maybe a bigger story.
I wrote on that just before the show, and I want to point out one thing about Briere, and it kind of speaks to some of the off-ice stuff that Ellen touches on sometimes about players. This guy, we know more about Briere than I think we ever thought we would because of his divorce. Like, when he had a terrible statistic year a few years ago, mm-hmm. he did a lot of interviews after the season that talked about how terrible his divorce was and how taxing it was on him and how it affected his kids and how it weighed on him and the whole thing. And then on top of that, we had the Flyers featured on 24/7. And you get glimpses of his home life when Drew was living with him and his kids and the whole thing. And he became like Daddy Briere. And I got to admit that when I saw the buyout or when I first heard of the buyout and realized it was going to happen, my first thought obviously was, how does this affect the Flyers' cap situation? What are they going to do with the money? But my second thought is, well, what about those kids? And I am not someone who ever thinks about the off-the-ice life of players. I could care less. But for whatever reason, Briere's story, I think, has been told in a way where we see him differently because of that. And I think it's part of the narrative now with him.
It was weird. You know, that year that the Flyers went to the final against the Blackhawks, that was a year. I remember talking to Glenn Healy about this when I was still at Hockey Night. And he was doing it in between the benches. He said it was the worst year for the Stanley Cup. First year for the Philadelphia Flyers to go to the Stanley Cup final because on that team, there were five guys that were going through divorces. And if you know anything about what happens on the ice with guys chirping each other, he said everything was up for grabs and he never heard it as salty on the ice as he did in that Chicago Philadelphia right? Flyers with five right? guys getting divorced. He said it was brutal on the ice.
It's funny.
Yeah. But it's obviously a good move. I'm more interested to see what the next move for Briere is. Like, I was talking to some people last night about this, and you could make the argument if everybody you expect to re-sign re-signs that are UFAs, that he's could be the best forward on the market this summer. And if that's
David
the case,
Clarkson, thank you very much.
Well, he's got better numbers than David Clarkson, doesn't he?
But yeah, who has different types of players, Wish. Like, if you're the Edmonton Oilers, for example, who I understand will make a significant play for David Clarkson, you're not going to make the same type of play for Danny Briere.
The three places that I thought about immediately when he becomes available, one, would Montreal dabble? I mean, there's been several regime changes there since he spurned them for the Flyers. Yep. So would they dabble? Phoenix was where he got his start, and Tippett's been looking for a veteran scorer ever since they didn't re-sign Ray Whitney. If he went back to Buffalo, would he become Daniel again, is my basic question about that with the Sabres. But I think there's going to be a lot of interest in him. And the other interesting thing about Briere, and it kind of speaks to something that Delo's dealt with before, is the idea of being clutch. He's a better-than-point-per-game player in the playoffs throughout his career.
Sure, but he's played mostly in the Eastern Conference.
Well, there you go. That's such a crutch. But the point is that if Joel Ward gets a contract for being good one season, what does Danny Briere get for being better than a point per game in 108 games? Like, would there be value in that for a general manager of a team that expects to make the playoffs to be in the Danny Briere business simply because he's known as a clutch playoff performer?
There are two teams that jump out at me. And the first one was the New York Islanders, who are in love more so than anybody else with the reclamation project. And the other, and this hits you where you cheer, Wish, the New Jersey Devils.
Yeah.
Come on.
Listen, I see. So if he went to the Devils, and that's an interesting point because from a, again, familial aspect, he'd be kind of still local.
Yep.
I think that I would come down with Claude Lemieux syndrome, which is that I think Danny Briere is a dirty little bastard when he plays with little, you know, butt ends of sticks to people's faces on face-offs and all the other garbage.
Yeah, it's fine.
But I think I'd rather like him as a Devil.
The Devils are an interesting choice for him because they're a team that, you know, like they have trouble finishing, and he's a guy who's got some skill.
Yep.
And I think he said that he wants to stay on the East Coast, just given that, you know, I didn't know about his divorce. I'm not a guy who follows the families like you guys, I guess. But, you know, I assume he's got kids there and he wants to be there. So the Devils probably make sense. But I think I interrupted Jeff, and Jeff had another team he might go to.
No, that was it. Those are the two, the Devils and the Islanders.
Yeah. Okay.
What do you think of the Habs?
I don't like that idea. I mean, I don't think he'd want to. My impression is that he doesn't want to play in Montreal.
He had the choice once. He said, no, thank you.
Well, he had the choice, but he took the Flyers because they gave him a gigantic front-loaded deal. It's not as if the Habs weren't in the mix.
Habs would have offered this. I honestly wish. I really don't think he wanted to play in Montreal.
But he's a Gatineau boy.
I know, but have you seen what provincial taxes are in Quebec?
Yeah.
I assure you, sir.
I think they're like 70% or something.
It is.
Well, also, after just getting bought out, does he want to go to a place where he's going to be under that kind of pressure and that kind of attention? I mean,
I don't think so.
These are weird buyouts, though. There shouldn't be any stigma attached to them because they're, you know, compliance buyouts.
It's but you don't think there would be in the media?
Nah, I don't think so. There's going to be really good hockey players who get bought out, it sounds like, or just given away for nickels on the dollar.
Should there be any stigma attached to any buyout, though? I mean, in some cases, it's simply just like...
Well, I think generally, I think we've lost Greg again, so I'll respond to his point. I think what Greg was going to say is that there shouldn't be stigma attached to buyouts because it's just a team and a player recognizing it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I think Greg's wrong. To me, and stigma is maybe the wrong word, but if a guy's been bought out, it means basically that the GM can't find anybody to take him under any circumstances at all. And it sort of speaks to the league's view of what the player's value is. And, you know, so when you look at players who've been bought out, generally, if they are able to get a contract, it's pretty minimal. You know, like the only ones that stick out to me where the player got decent money after being bought out are Sheldon Surrey and Cam Barker, who got huge money in Edmonton.
Darian Hatcher. Darian Hatcher. Oh, you're back.
What I was saying before before the internet really interrupted me. Like, I think Gomez should have a stigma because he was terrible and earned his buyout. But I think a guy like Wade Redden is a victim of circumstance. So I think there are shades of gray as far as buyouts go, and not every guy should have a stigma.
Yeah, fair enough. And maybe big dollar guys who go down to the minors, that's kind of a tell, because Surrey did that too, right? He was shuttled down to Hershey or wherever.
But let me ask you this. Spite, though. Like that was the Oilers organization being spiteful.
Oh, sure, but my point is that he could play, right? It wasn't a spite thing.
Hey, if you can play, you can play. But I guess my question is about Brizgalov. Like, if he gets bought out this year, what's the stigma? Like, did he earn that buyout, or was he simply given a gigantic contract that no goaltender should ever be given because they'll never live up to it?
Well, he did have I agree with you, Greg. You know, I think maybe the stigma, if there's a buyout for Brizgalov, should attach to the Flyers, not so much to Brizgalov.
let's not even say Flyers. Let's just say Ed Snyder. Okay, let's narrow it down.
Not even the GM, it's the owner's decision.
Exactly.
Find me the next Tim Thomas. Sorry, Al.
I think that's true in general, though. Usually a buyout is a kind of public repentance for a giant UFA excess. Like, you got into a bidding war over a UFA, went insane, and then, you know, a few years later, there's nothing you can do about it. So yes, it should probably attach to the team more than the player. On the other hand, for the player, it is sort of a taking away of all of that hype that went with being the big money player, and sort of saying, like, okay, we've all agreed that you're not actually worth all of this, you know. So I think, I mean, and you could say there shouldn't be a stigma attached to Wade Redden, but, I mean, the guy was used as a punchline for years.
It was, for sure.
I wonder, too.
I mean, to the point where there was a rule that was created in his name.
Yeah, you can only absorb, was it $900,000, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
And pass that accounts against your salary cap for the new CBA. You know, players can't stand it. Players, you know, feel this is like a professional slight on their career when you get bought out. But I do wonder, too, because if you use the Wade Redden example, Wade Redden had a choice, and the money was, as I understand it, pretty much identical. He had a choice to go to the Rangers or the Columbus Blue Jackets. Now, there's no way, and I know you might throw my Commodore up at me here, but, you know, that's a different scenario, and the money involved is more significant on the Wade Redden side. I don't think there's any way that the Columbus Blue Jackets would have done to Wade Redden what the New York Rangers did. I was of the impression when that happened that players would start to look at their contract situations when they sign free agent deals and say, I'm only going to go to a team that I know will not down the road buy me out.
Yeah, I don't think I buy into that. For me, it's sort of, you talk about the expectations people have when they enter into a relationship, right? Nobody gets married thinking they're going to get divorced, and yet 40% of marriages end in divorce. And, you know, so I think when, you know, guys see Redden end up in the minors, or Surrey end up in the minors, maybe it's a bit different with Surrey, but we'll talk about Redden. When they see Redden end up in the minors, they go, ah, man, that sucks for him, but that's not going to happen to me because I'm a really good player, and my situation's different. And I have a hard time, unless you have a team that's just consistently doing it. I could see a team getting a bad reputation, but then, you know, come the summer, if that team's offering you $1 million a year and a few extra years, or $1 million a year more and a few extra years, guys go, ah, it won't happen to me.
It's a question.
Got again. Okay, well, then here becomes a question. As everyone's hot button issue and topic, certainly around playoff time where he has a hard time.
Seriously, I think I'm being F with now. How could I say, here's a question for Tyler and Ellen, and that's when the internet drops out?
Doesn't like the internet. I know. It's Colin Campbell is running the internet today.
All right, listen. The question for Tyler and Ellen is this. It's, do you like the idea of teams having wiggle room, of teams having ways to get out from under these contracts, or are you more of the mindset that if you sign someone to a deal and that deal doesn't work out, then you should be saddled with it?
I personally like deviousness. I like the cat and mouse game that the NHL is always playing with its coaches and general managers, where they try to make a rule that, like, You'll have to carry your contracts and honor them no matter what. And then there's a few extenuating circumstances that they have to make allowances for. And then somebody finds a way around it completely. Like, mm-hmm. I love that. I don't know if I'm in favor of officially granted wiggle room, but I like it when somebody can get away with something on a technicality.
Well, I'm a lawyer, so obviously I'm a fan of technicality and finding wiggle room. But I don't really think a lot of what we see is necessarily that. Like, to me, the rules are the rules. Everybody acts within the rules. And you know, the players signed a deal that allowed for compliance buyouts. I probably don't like it as much as most, just because I'm a fan of a team that has a harder time getting players. And I would like to see teams like New York and Montreal and Philadelphia sort of pay for their sins a little more with, you know, Brzgalov on the salary cap for the next 10 years or whatever's left.
Yeah, for those that don't know, by the way, Tyler's a fan of the Edmonton Oilers, and now the salary cap, and one specifically going down to $64.3 million. Do you think it's still as much of a challenge now as it was before for the Oilers to get players? Knowing that, you know, some teams just, listen, you just don't have the cap space to sign a player. And where once upon a time, a lot of things go into the decision. You know, the money is an issue. The geography is an issue. The climate is an issue. Right now, when it comes down to it, players sort of look at themselves and say, I have X amount of years to make X amount of money. It really doesn't matter where I play.
Yeah, the problem with that line of thinking, though, is that, you know, you ask yourself, well, where is Edmonton on the food chain of places players would like to play? Because even if it doesn't matter where they play, you know,
they just
make
have
the
to win,
money.
Tyler. They just have to win.
No, I believe that. I'm a huge believer of that, and I get irritated when people say, "Oh, you know, nobody wants to live in Edmonton. Nobody wants to live in Edmonton. Nobody wants to play for a terrible team."
That's bingo.
Yeah,
exactly.
And so, but I do think, you know, yeah. So if they become a winning team, I don't think it'll matter as much. I think it's very difficult for a team like the Oilers in this system to move from being a bad team to a good team, relying on getting free agent players, just because players will go, well, you know, if I'm going to play for a bad team, I can play for a bad team with nice weather. And, you know, that's you know, something that the Oilers are never going to be able to overcome.
And no taxes. Hello, Florida, Florida, Tampa, and Dallas.
Although I'd be remiss if any NHL players who are good are listening, Edmonton has very low tax rates relative to the rest of Canada. So Edmonton is a place you should be considering.
Nathan Horton, you're paying attention right now.
Hey, I have to punt to Chicago availability.
Yeah, get out of here. We're done with
Merrick mentioned that. But I want to mention one thing about the Lindy Ruff hiring that we didn't bring to the forefront. How we know this news. According to the Star-Telegram, we know Lindy Ruff's going to be the next coach of the Dallas Stars because Stars president Jim Leitz said at a Fort Worth Chamber of Commerce luncheon that they're in the process of hiring Lindy Ruff. First ever coaching hiring announced at a Chamber of Commerce luncheon. I believe we've made some history here.
Well, yeah, although, hang on, Mike Hyka just tweeted this one out. Just talked to Jim Leitz. He said, tap the brakes on Lindy Ruff hiring. Said they like him a lot, but nothing is done yet.
That was wonderful.
That was awesome.
Oh, Jim Leitz.
That's fantastic.
We hired Lindy Ruff and unhired him in the process of about 25 minutes.
Pretty quick. All right, you got your media availability to get to.
Yeah, I got to get to it, but real quick, as far as question of the day, which was who impressed you the most in Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Final, which was an amazing game last night, an unpredictable game, a crazy wild game. Who impressed me the most? I would have to say that the...
Perfect. You know what? Just punt him. He's done. He's finished. The internet is conspiring against
him. That was the perfect climax for his
I don't have control. It's up to him if he comes back.
Oh, really?
You should teach Greg to be more concise.
I'm back. Oh, okay.
Don't you want to run in. Just give us your answer.
Yeah, that was really,
run in,
that
chair
was really
shot,
dramatic.
Run in, chair shot, and then you're done. Quick.
That was really dramatic. Jonathan Toews. Really impressed me last night.
Taves was.
See you. Bye.
I love Taves.
Get out of here. And actually, you brought up an interesting stat today on either. I was on your Twitter, and you said 80%
of
Jonathan Taves' shifts were against ice time. Against
at 5-on-5. Yep. 80% of his ice time at 5-on-5 was against Chara last night. The Hawks got about 57% of the shot attempts when he was on the ice. And, like, people don't do that to Zdeno Chara. Like, you know, when the Toronto media was kind of kicking Phil Kessel for not doing well against Chara. Like, you know, there were guys who were going and looking how Chara does against people. And the Bruins crushed guys when Chara's on the ice, even great players. And so, you know, when you talk about Jonathan Toews, I think some of the criticism's been a bit unfair because they've had the ice tilted towards Boston's end with him on the ice, and he's been running toe-to-toe with Chara.
Just hasn't scored. Sorry, jumping all over you. Ellen's been trying to get in.
Oh, no, it's okay.
Is it from a conversation like 3 topics ago?
Yeah.
You want to revisit it? Want to jump in on it again? Who do you think was the most yesterday was maybe not who was the most impressive, but which player do you think was the biggest story? Because Corey Crawford was clearly a story, as every shot went over his glove hand. Chara was a story. Taves was a story last night. Patrick Sharp was a story last night. Johnny Boychuk was it. Was there one guy last night that really popped for you on either side?
I was honestly just happy to see Taves shake a little bit of the criticism he was getting, because I thought it was ridiculous and really unfair, the extent to which he was being blamed sort of nebulously for just like not finishing or not putting up goals when, as Tyler said, you have a preponderance of evidence that he's playing very well under very difficult circumstances. And I think even visually you can see that he's playing well. And I really hate it. I mean, goal scoring is difficult and contingent on a lot of things that are...
Not last night.
Yes. Contingent on a lot of things that aren't within the player's control. And it really bugs me when, as a matter of analysis, people take it as if it's something that a guy should just be able to turn on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if there was somehow something he could do to, like,
the goal
kick
switch.
It up and make it...
Yeah, well, McGillney had it. Bossy had it. How come you don't have it? Well, it was clearly a different era. It was you see, when I looked at last night's game, I said to myself, you look at whenever Chicago needs to get back into a series, they put 19 and 88 together, whether it's against the Detroit Red Wings, whether it's against Los Angeles, that's just what they do. And it took until game 4 for Joel Quenneville to put that combination together, Pat Kane and Jonathan Toews. And more so, further to Tyler's point about the 80% of his ice time against Zdeno Chara 5-on-5, doesn't it underscore one basic truth about most hockey players, most elite level hockey players? They crave challenges. Like, they don't want to be hidden. I'm sure if you ask Jonathan Taves, I was saying a wish on the podcast yesterday, guys. The one question I would love for someone to ask Jonathan Taves in a scrum is, how do you feel about your coach hiding you from Zdeno Chara? Because most players want best on best. Like, they want that challenge. If you ask Jonathan Taves, I want to be on the ice every time he's out there.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to have to jump back to the bench when I see 33 come out.
Well, and purely as a matter of tactics, if I'm Jonathan Taves, do I want to be sheltered from Chara and then see weaker players on my team having to take that matchup?
Yeah, go let Andrew Shaw mess around with Zdeno Chara. But it really is like best great hockey players want to play against the other great hockey players. That's the challenge that they all crave. Like, that's part of their DNA, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I agree with you, and I think it's a shame. And you know, 5 years from now, it'll probably be better, but we'll understand more. You know. Like, I think Taves should be getting some more credit for being sort of run right into the teeth of Zdeno Chara. But we don't really talk about those matchups, I think, enough when they're happening. And, you know, we don't recognize maybe that, you know, the value that Taves provides, even if he's not putting up as much offense, because he's going out and pounding against Chara over and over and over. And then that leaves, you know, the non-Chara minutes for the rest of the players on his team. And, you know, so I think there's kind of a real contribution that a player can make there. And I tend to agree with you, right? Like, it's... you know, if you're Jonathan Taves, I want to say, yeah, I won the Stanley Cup, and I helped do it because I, you know, fed Zdeno Chara his lunch.
Yeah, I want to be out there against Chara, with all due respect. I don't want to be out there against Adam McQuaid. I want that challenge. It's funny, you know, whenever I look at Zdeno Chara, and Ellen, I think you're the same way, you sort of look, okay, who was this guy in the 70s? Who was this guy in the 60s? And the player I keep coming back to as being, you know, the prototypical Zdeno Chara in his era was Larry Robinson. I always look at Larry Robinson and say, that was Zdeno Chara in the NHL before Chara came along. I mean, Larry was big and he was mobile, had the big shot and the big presence, and he ended the myth of Dave Schultz and the Philadelphia Flyers, dragged him out of that brawl and beat the stuffing out of him. That was the end of the Broad Street Bullies. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that every now and then, I guess it would happen to Larry, we get a little bit snappy, but I don't know that I've ever seen Zdeno Chara get as snappy as he did last night, where he's completely at times uninterested in the play and more interested in chasing Brian Bickle or taking extra jabs and whacks at Jonathan Taves. Like, did that seem like one of the most, Seidenberg for the second game in a row plays more minutes than Chara? Did that seem one of the weirdest games you ever saw Zdeno Chara play? It was bizarre. It was like he was a totally different, and it's not as if he's 22 years old, you know, fresh out of Prince George, just, you know, into the NHL. Like, here's a veteran guy with Stanley Cup and a Norris Trophy. It seemed like that was the weirdest game I ever saw Chara play. You guys agree or disagree?
I think you're right. I think he's usually extraordinarily disciplined.
Totally. To the point, can I interrupt? Mm-hmm. I would actually, I've made this point before on the show, I would give him the Lady Bing trophy every single year. I'm serious. I'm very serious about this. I would give him the Lady Bing trophy every year because of what he chooses not to do on the ice. Like, if that guy every game wanted to destroy dudes, he would. But the fact that he doesn't, to me, by definition of that trophy, the most gentlemanly player in the NHL, give that man the trophy every year. He may eat it, but give Zdeno Chara the Lady Bing trophy every year for what he chooses not to do. That's how scary the guy is.
Absolutely. I mean, he could be the most terrifying physical player hockey has ever seen,
mm-hmm,
if he really wanted to focus on that, if he wanted to, I don't know, let himself go more often.
But he has that, you're right, he has that, like, unbelievable restraint. Like,
yeah.
He has, like, okay, I'm not going to cross this line.
Bruce Arthur had a really good story the other day.
It's awesome.
And,
it's a great piece.
Yeah, it's a great piece. But, yeah, well, then I won't repeat his stories, but that's absolutely a point that Bruce made. And sort of talking even about how Chara's reacted when he has injured people in the past. Like, you know, I don't think there's very many guys in the NHL who, you know, wouldn't feel bad if they hurt somebody. Just nobody wants to hurt anybody badly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Chara does seem like a guy who, like, I agree with you. He could ruin people and
could ruin careers.
Yeah, and he doesn't. So that is Jeff, in the great tradition of the Professional Hockey Writers Association, I hope you get a vote soon and you can start with your own definition of the Lady Bing Trophy to the guy who...
I don't have a vote. I'm part, it's so weird. Like, I exist in this weird spot in hockey media where I do a little bit of television, I do podcasts, I do a little on our website, but I don't really have, like, one real position. I'm kind of like a fog. Like, I'm not part of the Professional Hockey Writers Association, not part of the Broadcasters Association. Like, I'm part of, like, nothing. Yet I'm, like, the most mainstream media guy. Like, I'm on television 5 days a week. But I'm not really part of anything. I'm not part of any, like, broadcast association or Hockey Writer Association clubs.
If you started like a blog about a Southern NHL team, they'd probably let you into the Professional Hockey Writers Association.
Yeah, yeah, you're probably right. Here's something for you, and we'll get to this as the closeout game approaches. But I'm always curious to hear people's opinions because I'm not a fan of it because I think it's inherently phony and I think it's inherently forced. Where are you guys on handshakes?
I don't know. They are forced, but
You know when two kids fight in school?
Yeah,
and the principal says, "All right, you two, now go shake hands."
I thought it was really weird watching this playoffs, just watching the demeanors of some of the guys going through the line.
Carlson and Cook.
Yeah, well,
that was a big one.
The best one for me was Luongo. Like Luongo going through the line, and I've never seen a guy look happier. Like
it's over. Season's finally done.
Yeah, yeah. He's patting guys on the chest. He's
buddy. You know, me and the wife are having a barbecue this weekend. Why don't you come on over? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, like I'm not gonna blame Luongo for being upset about the way things have gone. I think he's handled it really, really well. But you could tell, you know, like it's kind of like the mask comes off and you see, you know, how guys feel about things. And I thought it was interesting. Doughty kind of was grinning going through the line, too. So I kind of enjoy the handshake lines just for the chance to watch the interactions between the players. And actually,
even if you know that a lot of the guys can't stand it. Like a lot, I remember the famous quote was always Stan Mikita, a legendary former Blackhawk, who said, and he hated handshakes. He said, I just won't do it. He said, I can't shake the hand of a man who just put his hand in my pocket and took my money. And he said that when the Red Wings beat the Blackhawks one year for the Stanley Cup, he said, it meant more to me to have Gordie Howe come into our room and toast us with a glass of champagne and congratulate us on a series than some phony handshake line.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But I also think players should be willing to skip handshakes and just say,
agree.
You know, and I've done that a couple times in my life. Like my beer league guys just said, you know what? Like I was getting sticked. I was covered in bruises. Like I would go home. We had a playoff series. I'd go home and I'd take off my shirt or something. My girlfriend like, oh my God, what happened to you? And you know, it was a really nasty, mean series. It was ridiculous. But at the end, I was like, I'm not shaking hands with these jerks. And I think my team's. Yeah. Teammates appreciate it because they figure there might be a brawl. So, you know, but I think NHL players, I think that should become recognized as like a valid option. Sure. Like if you've played a team that's got, you know, that's, you know, behaved dishonorably, like I guess it would matter more if it wasn't required. Like if it was like, and that's basically what you're saying about Howe and Mikita, right? Like when Howe goes into the dressing room, toasts them with he doesn't have to do that. That's a genuine gesture.
Whereas that was Mikita's point.
Absolutely. And the handshake has become so rote that it's just like a little bit of theater that they play out for us. But I do think sometimes it's really cool, or not cool, but like that commercial they're running right now showing the handshake line, right? It's not you don't win until you shake on it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's got Ryan Smith, you know, giving Ray Whitney a hug in the handshake line.
Yep.
Like sometimes, and for those of you who don't know, Ray Whitney played for the Oilers in 1998, and they waived him and he went to Florida, and the Oilers couldn't score, and Whitney scored like 70 points in Florida. And, you know, so Ray Whitney is an Edmonton boy. And
stick boy for the team.
He was, and his dad was their practice goalie for years and years and years. His dad's a guy named
Cop, right?
Yeah, Floyd Whitney.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was, you know, I like the moments like that in the handshake, right, where you've got guys who got relationships and you see, you know, like Smith giving Whitney a hug. That's kind of a neat little moment, even though it was kind of brutal to watch it again and again and again. But yeah, so much of it is just theater. I'm,
Where are you at it on it, Ellen?
I think it's cute. And I mean, I like the theatrical aspect of it. And lately, I'm just coming around a lot more in hockey to the fact that I like the theatrical aspect and I'm not going to apologize for it.
See, because to me, if I can interrupt, and you can look for this in, certainly, yeah, I'm sure you can find this type of device in literature. But to me, that handshake line, to me, is not about the players. As much as we think it's about the players and the hug, it's all about relieving tension for the fans. This thing is over.
I agree with you. I don't think it's for the players at all. Although I do like Tyler said, the moments that you get, like, because a lot of times it is people just sort of going through and like,
yeah.
And then every now and then you see like who like actually sort of stops to talk or have a longer interaction or who's like visibly hostile.
Will Marty shake Avery's hand? The answer, no.
Oh, good for Marty though. Like,
I agree.
Avery's a
jerk. Too.
Yep.
But having the forced ritual also then creates that space for it if more players would take advantage of it.
Well, yeah, and, you know, you talk about, like, it's a shame that I think both Taves and Chara are pretty, you know, decent guys who don't like to make a spectacle. But when Bettman comes out on the ice with the cup, I think it'd be fantastic if whichever one of them is receiving it just didn't skate over. Just say, wait for you to leave, and then I'll come pick it up. Because, you know, these guys had lots. Well, no, the players had lots to say about Gary Bettman during the lockout.
Yeah.
You know, if that's how you feel about him, you know, don't let him be part of the moment. You know, don't give him that moment.
Yeah, but then, you know, they don't give the captaincy to guys who will do that kind of interesting thing.
But then, you know what? You know what I'd say to that, too? I would say then don't cash any checks from Jeremy Jacobs. And if your contract is expiring, don't re-sign with the Boston Bruins.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think
a lot of people, I mean, a lot of, and for good reason, the Players Association side took a lot of shots at Jeremy Jacobs for how he behaved.
Yeah, well, but it's the same too with, you know, Craig Leupold. Like, if the NHL, like, honestly, you know, if the NHLPA really wanted to dissuade owners from doing this sort of stuff, you got to walk out a line legally, but, you know, players would remember and they would keep that in mind when they were deciding where to go.
Got about 10 minutes left here, guys. I want to get your thoughts on some of the things that the general managers gave the thumbs up to yesterday, some various rule changes. Curious where you guys are at on the grandfathering in of visors, the windshields.
Well, I asked this on Twitter yesterday because they're grandfathering in visors, yep, and there's going to be a 2-minute penalty if you remove your helmet before a fight. Like, I guess it's a 2-minute minor.
Yeah, and it's a penalty if you remove your visor. I don't know how you would remove the visor and take it off on the bench. Crosby did that with Mark Savard once. When Savard, they're challenging each other, and Savard did you got the windshield on. So Crosby went to the bench and took the windshield off, and still Mark Savard wouldn't fight him.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, does this effectively mean the end of fighting?
It's the beginning.
At the point when, after the current generation that doesn't have to wear visors ages out.
I think guys will still fight with visors on.
Yeah, but I
then, like, and then we're going to have
but
a...
But then, you know what? All you're doing is taking a 5-minute penalty and turning it into a 7.
Yeah.
Right? But
that's right. That's right, actually. If you get two good, you know, quote-unquote tough guys with visors and they just go, we want to both chuck our helmets,
But is it... so it would just be, like, coincidental.
Yeah, coincidental minus, so it turns like a 5 into a 7.
Yeah.
I wonder if the way you get around it is the way all those... enterprising young men from the Western Hockey League, Tyler Dello, do it, where it is a penalty if you take off your helmets. So before the fight, all they do is undo a chin strap.
I already thought of that.
They're not taking the helmet off, but, you know, first punch, the bucket's going. So that's the legal lawyer across from me here.
There's your loophole right there. Yeah. Until there's a rule that your chin strap has to be done up when you drop the gloves, that's an easy
out. But I think, like, if you're going to make the rule that says you have to keep your helmet on, how long is it before you realize that there's this quick workaround and say, okay, then you actually have to keep your chin strap on.
I think that, to your point, I think fighting is on its way out anyway. I think that, it's the heyday of it was the late 70s to the early to mid 80s. That's when, I mean, Quebec and Montreal were going for it. The Islanders and Rangers were going for it. Geez, Calgary and Edmonton. I mean, they had an SI cover piece about it once, I think, in 1985 or 86. And since then, fighting is continuing to dwindle down almost to a flicker in some people's estimation. But I think, I mean, there's a school of thought in the NHL that goes like this. And I believe this because I'm the guy they're talking about. There's two kinds of fans. There are fans that really like fighting and there are fans that really don't like fighting. And the question the NHL is asking itself is, if we got rid of the fighting, how many fans would we lose as opposed to how many fans would we gain? Because you know what? I like fighting. But if it went away tomorrow, I wouldn't. I'd still stick with the game. I'd still be there 100%. It's a part of the game that I enjoy, but I'm not going to leave if that's no longer part of the equation. I think the NHL is thinking to itself, we're trying to plan, try to strategically figure out how we can appeal to fans that think that fighting is barbaric, yet not lose hockey fans that we already have who enjoy fighting.
The thing of it is, though, right, like, if you're somebody who likes fighting, the NHL can't compete with, like, UFC or boxing, right? Like, if you just really like seeing dudes fight and you're getting your fix of dudes fighting by watching hockey games, like, there's a lot of dead time where people are just playing hockey. Nobody's fighting. It's awful.
But that was my point. Like, to me, everyone thinks, a lot of people think, these guys that like fights, all they want to see in hockey is the fights. No. To me, a hockey fight has always been like the pepper and parsley on in a bowl of soup. Like, I'm ordering the bowl of soup, but it comes with vanilla drizzle. Oh, that's great. I love that. That's fantastic. But I'll still like the cold cantaloupe soup.
Yeah, well, that, and that's, you know, my take on it is if they got rid of fighting tomorrow, nobody's going to stop watching hockey.
I won't, yeah, but I love fights.
Yeah, but...
But I think that's the thing. Like,
yeah, but you
but
watch UFC. You go to Montreal and watch guys,
it's
you know?
True. But that's my point is, like, I won't leave.
Yeah.
Like, I think there are a lot more people... I think the NHL is kind of scared of losing hockey fans that actually like fights. But I would argue that those fans aren't going to leave. They're
not
going to go.
But my point is that the NHL, like, you know, if people who like fights, they already have options that have, you know, way more fighting than hockey.
That are actually honest about it.
Yeah, that are honest about it. Yeah. And like, so if you want to watch fights, there's outlets for you to do that. Like, if you're watching the NHL, you're watching it for more than just the fighting. Nobody watches hockey for just the fighting because there are more efficient ways to get your high from fighting, you know?
Ellen, you've written extensively about hockey fights. Your most recent post, as a matter of fact.
Well, and that's what I was going to say about this is that I think the fact that now you can break it down into, like, that you can compare it to MMA and put people who just sort of like watching fighting in a sort of separate category. I think most hockey fans didn't really like watching fighting. They liked fighting as an element of the storyline that could happen in a game. Like, they believed that it could serve certain functions in terms of protecting players or swinging momentum.
Oh, I think that's all pretentious. Can I say bullshit on this show?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Bullshit.
You don't think people genuinely believe that?
No, though? I don't think that. I think guys who like to watch guys smack people in the face say that so they sound classy.
Let me ask you this question, because not just the fight itself. I don't think the fight itself is as meaningful as the threat of a fight, as far as curbing what happens on the ice.
I'm also not talking about actual effects. I'm talking about it fitting into the game in a way that does relate to the hockey. The ability to tell yourself that this fight that I'm watching reflects the real emotions of the game and, like, the real competitive dynamic between these teams.
I think
which people
say
used
that,
to be able to believe.
I don't think very don't many think people behave as if they... I think they say that. I think, you know, everyone spouts it as a justification. I don't think people believe, or I don't think people act in ways... You know, it's harder to say with fans, but I don't think people act in ways that are consistent with that belief. Like, if people really believe that fights are about turning momentum and whatnot, you'd send a guy out in the third to beat the hell out of somebody in a tie game to get the momentum your way.
But then why? But my question always becomes then, because neither the three of us play in the NHL, but whenever you talk to an NHL player, they'll tell you, you know what, that fight changed something on our bench. And I can't disqualify someone's experience. If that hockey players and those hockey players on those teams are saying, that really did something to our bench. That galvanized our bench. Yeah. That did something to us. Who am I to say, you're lying, you didn't feel that way? Because guys just, they continue to say it. That it is an actual thing.
It doesn't mean they're right about their perception, though. Like, people are notoriously bad.
But overwhelmingly, like, players, like, to a person will tell you, yeah, you know what? It was that fight that picked us up. It was that fight that did. Now, I'm not saying that it automatically leads to wins. It's because, like, not every power play leads to a goal. But there is something about it.
I don't understand. Like, if the fights pick up both teams, doesn't it cancel out?
But it doesn't always pick up both teams. It's funny. And there have been fights, and I think of the Talbot-Carcillo fight, where Max Talbot got fed his lunch, and it picked up. It picked up Max Talbot's team by getting beaten up by Dan Carcillo.
You can always tell who it picked up about, you know, as soon as the game's end. Yeah, yeah. Nobody ever says it picked up the team that lost, right?
But
it's always like, well, there was a fight, there was a hockey game, and this team won, so they got picked up.
I agree with you about using it as an actual explanation for outcomes. But just because it gets back to, again, you cannot tell people how to feel about the game they play or the experiences they're having.
Sure, but I don't have to take them seriously when they tell me their feelings and it's obviously...
No, you don't have to take them seriously.
Nonsense.
But the issue is, if a majority of NHL players feel this way, if a large majority of fans used to feel this way, then that in and of itself is a justification for allowing it to continue, unless you can come up to me with a much better reason why it should not.
Well, I don't know. Eventually someone will die, and maybe that'll be a good reason. But
eventually somebody will die.
Well,
I think eventually someone will die on the ice. And you know what it's going to be from?
Huh.
A shot.
Because
as more and more players go down to block shots, the pucks have to get higher to get past them.
Yeah. Well, that's... Mm-hmm.
And that was my main argument against increasing the size of the nets. Because Larry Quinn, who used to be the president of the Buffalo Sabres, his idea was to make the nets, you know, bigger and higher, because the idea was, if goaltenders go down on the butterfly, they're covering off the bottom of the net. Okay, well, that's fine. Then the compromise is give them shooters more space up top. And my thought has always been, get the pucks away from people's faces.
Yeah, no, I agree.
That's the one danger about blocking shots. Is, yeah, A, it's dangerous to players that are blocking the shot, but two, if I'm a defenseman, I got to get that shot through, and I don't want to hit shin pads, I'm sailing it up.
Yeah,
no, I think someone is going to die, but it's going to be from a shot, not a fight.
Yeah, no, that's not, it doesn't strike me as impossible. But, you know, with the fights, there's the culture that goes around it. And then, you know, you talk about, it's a difficult issue to get into in a small period of time. But you see a lot of guys like the Bugard thing, right? And you just wonder, like, that's what we hear about. But I assume
Reggie Fleming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah. Stuff like that. And, you know, it doesn't just have to be on the ice, right? Like, eventually, you know, guys like Derek Bugard, like, they become a marketing problem for the NHL because people and corporations look at the game and they go, is this something I want to be associated with?
And that's part of the big deal, which is they're the NHL, and rightfully so. And if I were them, I would be terrified of the NFL lawsuit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That the NFL is going now. But that's not just fights. That's
but yeah, I think it goes, I think the Bugard issue with the way that the damage that the game does to players and the way that the NHL makes use of people with problems goes beyond fighters and fighting. I don't think the two things are coterminous.
No, fair enough.
Let's talk about something fun before we wrap up.
Yes.
Looks like this may be the beginning of the end of the Spinnerama in the shootout. A good thing or a bad thing, this thing may be on its way out. The issue is forward momentum of the puck, and does the player interfere with the goaltender when he does it?
I like the Spinnerama. I'm a fan of creative, insane, likely to be unsuccessful shootout moves. I think if you're going to have the shootout, it should be as goofy as possible.
I think Jesse Spector or Sean Gentile, one of those guys, had a good line about it yesterday. Anytime you take something that ends in a rama out of your sport, you're making it less fun. So I completely agree with that. I do think the interference of the goalie is an issue, though. Like, frequently you'll see guys do it, and as they're coming around, the back of their body. Exactly. And so I have an issue with that because it is kind of goaltender interference. But beyond that, I think guys should be able to do whatever they want in the shootout. I think,
I'm with you. I'm with both of you guys. Now, how about this one? I'll throw this out of... throw my little nickel and dime ideas out there wherever I get an audience. How about the idea of, for those that hate shootouts, do them before every game and make that shootout your tiebreaker. So you'll get a shootout every single game before the game. And so you have established one team has the tiebreaker. You're playing, Toronto's playing in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Montreal wins the shootout, which happens before the game. You get clean ice, it's a cleaner shot, more competitive. So let's say Montreal wins a tiebreaker. And it's 3-3 with 2 minutes left in the third period. You want to talk about a team going all out because it's going to be a tie, but the tiebreaker's always already been established, and the NHL will like this. Your games will end on time.
Oh, I love this.
And they'll
idea.
Get and they'll get to their 2-hour and 20-minute mark, which is where they want games to end. The shootout crowd is happy, and the we only like 5-on-5 hockey. Thank you very much. We don't want a game settled by a shootout. We want to watch a game to the end. They'll be happier now than having the game, quote unquote, decided by a shootout, which happens at the end of the game.
That's a fascinating idea because there's a lot of data that says that, like, since the shootouts come in with the third point being available, you can see that there's sort of an effect where if teams are tied in the last 10 minutes of the third period, nobody takes any risks. Mm-hmm. So you get sort of, you know, what they used to complain about, oh, God, the overtimes are boring because nobody wants to, you know,
just want to get their point and get out.
Exactly. Well, now we get that for like 10 minutes, 15 minutes of the third period, and that's awful.
The tiebreaker's already been set.
Exactly.
I would say you don't even need data to see that. Like, I feel like this routinely happens when I'm watching games and
you can tell
to the end.
Like,
people just start slacking off. The chances go way down.
Yeah, no, you probably don't, but I like to be able to back up what I believe. So like, I'm pretty, yeah, well, I know that exists. And so I'd have to think it through, but it's an interesting idea, right? Because it's all about how you are, you know, the incentives you create and how they affect behavior, right? And the NHL wants to create incentives for the most exciting behavior possible. So, you know, that's an intriguing idea. That's a really fun idea.
Well, if they want to create incentives for the most exciting behavior possible, then why are they talking about taking out the Spinnerama? Like, I think there is a thread of hockey thought where people really want boring. Like, people like the boring.
Well, I think it's leavened a little bit. Like, you know, yes, you want all the excitement, but you are trying to run sort of a fair competition, and you know, you are trying to have sort of some principles of competition in place, and you know, so the Spinnerama, there is an issue. It's less for me the forward movement, but again, the banging into the goalie. But you know, the NHL isn't always limited by the laws of a fair competition, or otherwise we wouldn't have some games worth 2 points, some games worth three.
What do you think about having penalties worth more or less than 2 minutes?
I just want them to be the full 2 minutes.
Oh, you want? Oh,
I
want
to go back.
Well,
to,
you know who wrecked it. You know who wrecked
it? Yes, I do.
It's your freaking team. All right, your power play wrecked it.
No, my team made it awesome, and then it was so awesome that nobody else could handle it and had to take it away from us.
We're talking to us a bunch of Canadians who used to dine out on power plays when the NHL used to have to serve the full 2 minutes. Maurice Richard, Jean Béliveau, and the rest of that clan would fill the net in one power play, and that would be it. They were so great on the power play that the NHL actually had to create a system whereby the minute a goal is scored, a player comes out of the box. Because you guys were too dominant. But again, mm-hmm. the NHL is always doing that. Like, they did that with the Montreal Canadiens power play. Uh-oh, Marty Brodeur and Marty Turco are too good at playing the puck. Let's bring in some trapezoids. Like, the NHL has always gone out of their way to kill an individual or a collective team skill set that a very limited amount of people or teams have in the league at that time.
Well, sure, because whenever you're dealing with a skill set like that, 10% of the teams are like, yes, we love this because we can do it. And 90% are like, oh, man, not this again. You know, it's no fair. Our goalie can't, we got Arthur Zerbe, and they got Brodeur out there making breakout passes. And so, teams, everybody acts in their self-interest, right? So teams are acting, in the ways that best benefit themselves, even if it makes the game less interesting sometimes. And the New Jersey Devils are not, immune from that. They've played some awfully boring hockey in the mid-90s because of World Cup.
Oh, killed crowds. I mean, they would win the Stanley Cup and the place wouldn't be full.
Yeah, well, because who wants to watch that, right? So I understand what you're saying. I think that the idea of sort of variable-length penalties is kind of an interesting one. But I guess I wonder where you draw the line. And
well, we already have it.
Well, with majors and... Yeah, I guess you're right. So it's not introducing...
Majors, minors, and penalty shots.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not introducing anything that doesn't already exist in the game.
Because one of my platitudes I've been, if you're going to do the automatic puck over the glass 2 minutes, that's harsh. Specifically if you're in an overtime or if you're in like last couple of minutes, why not make that a 1 minute penalty?
Yeah.
Like, why does that have to be a full two? Anyway, sorry, you've been trying to jump in on a point here, Ellen.
Well, actually, the NHL experimented with a system way back at the beginning where like the refs could use their own judgment to assign how many
discretion,
minutes.
Discretion, yeah, how many
That's
minutes
a bad
penalty
idea.
Was.
But it would be fun. One of the things I wanted to get back to with the idea of serving the full 2 minutes, I think part of it is it also could be potentially a solution to the entire question that we have with like suspensions and... I think there's a trend where the way people think about hockey is moving much more towards off-ice punishments, mm-hmm. like fines and suspensions, and what can the Department of Player Safety do after the fact to deter certain behaviors? And I think the system of penalties on the ice is actually really effective, far more effective than anything that player safety could do in terms of controlling player behavior and sort of getting people to do the kinds of things that we want them to do, not do the kinds of things we don't want them to do.
But do we really want them to do that and not to do that?
Mm.
Like, doesn't the I've always made this, this point has been pounded in various ways, but, hockey's rock and roll. It's not smooth jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's always kind of better with a little
but
bit
I like
of dirt.
But I like that trade-off. I like the idea of it being that, yes, you can cross the line. You can, it's not like other sports where, if you break the rules, you get like one warning and then you're out of there.
Yeah.
You can break the rules, but you have to make this trade-off. And the question is your desire to be rock and roll, is the value you think you're getting out of playing that way more than the harm that's going to come to you if your team has to play at a disadvantage?
I think hockey's always best when it's a little bit chaotic.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think
I understand, but then it's just a matter of where that line is, too. Like, you can't have complete chaos. You can't have rollerball. You can't have that. I understand that.
Well, I think the example is sort of trying to cut down on the headshots. Like, you look at Scott Stevens, if he had his career today, he would be a worse criminal than like Rafi Torres. He would just be unbelievable because, that was his thing. What do you do?
I
knock guys out for a living.
But the thing is, I think if Scott Stevens existed right now, he could still play in the NHL. He just wouldn't hit like that.
Oh, I agree. I completely agree. But
if that Scott Stevens, boom, teleported to this NHL.
Yeah. No, the guy could do, yeah, absolutely. But the guy, I'm sure he would adjust his game. But and I agree with you, Jeff. Like, I like that sort of element, risk in a game, chaos in a game. And when you talk about, you know, Torres is a big one for me, and I was really happy to see San Jose sign him this year because the guy can play hockey.
3 years, $6 million.
Absolutely. And but you look at that suspension he got on the hit on Jared Stoll in the playoffs. And even Stoll, like, Stoll didn't say it. Like, the really good thing to do would have been to say it before the player, Department of Player Safety did something with Torres. But Stoll said, he said, you know, I didn't think it was, there's anything to it. It was a hockey play. Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought too, right? Like, Stoll's moving his body. Like, guys are moving around out there. It's not a clean, slow sport. And guys miss a little bit. And on that, you know, if Torres hits him a fraction of a second earlier, or if Stoll's bent over a fraction of a second longer, he catches him in the shoulder and goes, wow, great hit. He totally blew up Stoll. So, you know, I think you have to accept that there's going to be that element to the game. And that's hockey.
What a perfect way to end it. Thanks so much for coming in, guys. Always
thanks
good
for
to see
us.
You, Ellen.
It was fun.
Always good to see you, Tyler. Anything to promote, to pimp out? Latest backhand shelf, latest blog at mc79hockey.com.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that we got screwed in the Koska Cup this weekend. I blame James Myrtle. I blame Ellen a little bit.
What happened?
I had nothing to do with it.
Oh, we played the Koska Cup at Maple Leaf Gardens. Uh-huh. And it was 40 Twitter personalities and people and girlfriends. And,
really?
Yeah, right? It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a mini tournament.
Many thanks to Mike Forbes for setting it up. My team won the round robin, but lost somehow 8-7 in the final.
8-7?
8-7.
Were you playing post? Did you have goalies?
We had goalies. We had
the goalie caddy out?
We had goalie we had Corey Crawford. And we lost 8-7 on a contentious slap shot, which is not, I say, not within the rules, but the guy took a slap shot. He beat the goalie. So the whole thing was rigged. We will fix it next year. Mm-hmm. If you like whatever I do, you can find it at MC79Hockey on Twitter, MC79Hockey.com on the internet.
I've never played with Delos. You good hockey player?
Better than me.
You just started a couple of years ago, Ellen.
Exactly.
How's your career coming, by the way? How are you liking it?
It's going pretty well. It's very hard for me to evaluate my own skill set.
Ellen's got game.
What can you do now that you never thought you'd be able to do when you first started?
What can I do now?
Take a hard pass, raise the puck, stay on side.
No, I survive. Like, I'm a better skater than I thought I would be. Mm-hmm. But my only real advantage is because I watch hockey so much and I listen to people talk about it so much, I'm pretty good with positioning. I still have really, really limited physical skills, though. I can raise the puck every now and then. I still can't receive passes. Like,
oh, really?
I hate playing forward because receiving a pass while I'm trying to go from behind me, while I'm trying to go ahead.
Toe drag it up your skates and kick it up. Come on, it's easy. It's pretty simple, Corey Perry. Come on. Well, it's good to see you both again. Continued success, and we will chat soon, Tyler Dello and Ellen Etchingham. Podcast returns tomorrow. Hopefully, Greg Wyshynski from a better location in the United Center. That was bad, eh, Josh? Yeah, that was like shades of American Stouffville.
He told me he's going to try to find a better spot tomorrow, so we'll test that before the show. We'll lock something down.
As long as he's going to try. That's the main thing. Thanks for joining us. Podcast back tomorrow, another day before Game 5 of the Stanley Cup Final, Blackhawks and the Boston Bruins. Thanks for tuning in. Back tomorrow right here at either PuckDaddySportsNet.ca or on your iTunes, everybody.
Go Hawks, go. Thank you.